Hello, everyone. You know, with Donald Trump's hush money case now in jury selection, what is normally a difficult and painstaking process on its own has some extra external pressures on it. Case in point.
My plea is to the people of Manhattan that may sit on this trial. Please do the right thing for this country. Everybody's allowed to have their political viewpoints, but the law is supposed to be blind and no respecter of persons. This is a trash case. There is no crime here. And if there is any potential for a verdict, they should vote not guilty.
That was Republican Congressman and Trump vice presidential shortlister Byron Donalds just yesterday. Despite having no involvement in the case, Donalds was using his platform to try to influence the jury from outside the courtroom. Conservative media personality Clay Travis did something similar, one step further, writing to his followers on social media that, quote, if you're a Trump supporter in New York City who is a part of the jury pool, do everything you can to get seated on the jury and then refuse to convict as a matter of principle, dooming the case via hung jury. It's the most patriotic thing you could possibly do. The patriotism is questionable. The illegality is not. This case is not about politics. Whether you love Trump or loathe Trump, no one should be trying to tamper with the jury. This case is about whether or not Donald Trump committed a specific series of crimes. But given who the defendant is, the worry that someone could be seated for the jury with a strong bias one way or the other, well, that worry is real. And that is why what is happening in court this week, the process of jury selection, is so important. Today, the first seven jurors were impaneled. It's four men and three women. Two of them are attorneys. One works in IT. One is a software engineer. One is a teacher. One is a nurse. And one is in sales. Jadwan Mershon told those jurors to plan to be in court for opening statements bright and early next Monday morning at 9:30 a.m. Now, before this case can begin, 12 jurors and six alternates have to be impaneled. So really, seven jurors being impaneled means that jury selection is only a third of the way done. Yesterday, when the first 96 jurors were called into Trump's courtroom, they were all asked simply, do you think you can be impartial in this case? More than half of them said no. That half was sent home. And that is the point. At the core of jury selection is a process called voir dire, essentially the process of questioning potential jurors to make sure the people who actually make it into the final jury can be impartial. The point of jury selection, the point of all this in this case, in particular, more than normal, is to separate the politics from the case. Today, Trump's defense team questioned potential jurors about their past social media posts. The defense team believes showed anti-Trump bias. The posts range from very direct, like Trump indicted in documents case, no one is above the law, to a meme posted by a juror's husband in 2016. Now, maybe those individuals do have strong feelings about Donald Trump, but also feel strongly that in a court of law, they can put aside those feelings and evaluate evidence without bias. Trump's legal team doesn't have to take that chance. They can and have struck jurors they believe could be biased, and the prosecution has the same power. For instance, one of today's potential jurors told the court that he has read multiple Trump books, a remark that drew a smile and a nod from Trump himself. Prosecutors could strike that juror if they believe he might be too biased in favor of Trump. They don't have to, but that is the process. And guess what? Ultimately, they did. The other X factor in all of this, of course, is Trump himself. Not only did the prospective jurors have to pass Trump protesters and a sea of press to get into court today, not only do they know that this case will be watched around the world, but when they actually get into the courtroom, they are seated just feet from the former president. Today, our colleague Von Hilliard interviewed a juror who was struck from the jury about what that was like.
What was that like answering questions, including some about Donald Trump, as he is sitting 30 feet from you?
It was odd. It was such an interesting experience because I had never seen him in person before, you know, and you see someone blown up so larger than life on the media for so many years. To see them in person is very jarring. And you get the sense that it's like, oh, this is just another guy. And also, he sees me talking about him, which is bizarre.
The fact that the defendant can see the jury, it shouldn't be an issue in a normal trial with a normal defendant. But this isn't a normal trial, and this certainly isn't a normal defendant. Today in court, while a juror was being questioned, Trump said something something no one outside the courtroom could hear, in the direction of the juror. Judge Marchand scolded Trump's legal team for it, saying, quote, "I will not have any jurors intimidated in this courtroom. I want to make this crystal clear." Joining us now, Duncan Levin, formerly with the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, as well as a former federal prosecutor, now in private practice, and Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney and MSNBC legal analyst. Thank you both so much for being here tonight. We were told to expect that this process could take 2 weeks. Michael Cohen has repeatedly said he believed it could take as many as 3 weeks. Are you surprised it is proceeding this quickly?
No, I think actually it's proceeding as quickly as every other trial. And I think what a lot of people are surprised at is how this is moving along at a pace that's very similar to other trials. And the only real distinction is that this defendant is somebody that most people know. And this yes. defendant is somebody where the crime is known. And so this is a different case because the jurors walk in and know who the defendant is. But at the end of the day, the process is the same. And Judge Marchand is an experienced juror, a jurist. He's been picking juries for years, and he's moving it along at a clip. And I think the most important thing that he came out of today's jury selection is that he is not going to allow social media posts to be used as a litmus test for bias and to kick people off of the jury. And that is why I think the defense is in a much more precarious position going into the second half, where more than half of the jury has to be picked, because they're going to clearly soon run out of these peremptory challenges and be left with jurors that they most fear, which are educated, politically democratic jurors that are going to not be able to get kicked off this jury for cause because of their social media posts. And so they're going into this with a disadvantage into the second half of this.
Joyce, your thoughts on how this is proceeding?
Well, I think that's really a great characterization, because today and yesterday, both sides had all of their peremptory strikes. These are the strikes the lawyers can use to remove jurors who they just don't like, who they have a bad feeling about, so long as they don't violate any of constitutional protections, race, national origin, or gender in doing that. But now they have far fewer of those peremptory strikes. They'll have to guard them cautiously because, as you pointed out, they're only about a third of the way there. And I think what we're seeing develop, by the way, and I think it's important to protect the identities of these jurors. There's a lot of data available about them from these questionnaires that they've answered. But by and large, these do look like people who have committed to be fair, who have committed to judge the case on the evidence that they hear in the courtroom. It doesn't look like a jury that leans strongly for either side at this point. I think that's a good thing, something that should give us confidence in the process.
Joyce, give us your reaction to that moment when you had Judge Marchand admonish Trump's attorney about Trump having that audible reaction to something a prospective juror was saying.
So, look, this is not happening in a vacuum. This is not a defendant who got excited and made an utterance. This is someone who has a long track record of using the megaphone that's strapped to his mouth to incite his followers against other people. This is someone who was the president of the United States and may well be again. And so the notion that he would do anything that even approached intimidating a potential juror in his case is absolutely unacceptable. I'm surprised the judge didn't stop him in the moment and admonish Donald Trump personally. He showed great restraint by not doing that in the presence of the juror, by waiting and telling the lawyers that it couldn't happen again. But this is an issue that this judge will inevitably face, whether it's the gag order ruling next week, whether it's Trump's in-court conduct. This is a defendant who cannot contain himself. He will not be able to behave. The judge will have to decide what to do about it at some point.
Well, to the point about him not being able to contain himself, the identity of these jurors should be kept private. And yet we know that Donald Trump is not a defendant who plays by the rules. If you are a juror, do you need to be nervous about the sharing of your public information about your identity? And what is it that the court can do to really protect those jurors?
Well, it's hard under the best of circumstances to be able to look somebody in the eyes and convict them of a crime.
Sure.
So I think that all of the jurors coming through the phalanx of police officers, they cordoned off blocks of the courthouse this morning, and they're walking through this on their way to jury service. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to be that much harder for jurors to convict convict in the case. Not that they won't, but it's just that that's going to weigh on their minds. But I think a lot of people don't realize in New York State in 2020, there was a new bail reform act that was passed that really hamstrings what Judge Merchan can do with regard to the violation of a gag order. Mm-hmm. And what I think people don't realize is that, because I've seen a lot of commentary saying throw him in jail for violating the gag order, but really the judge is limited in what he's allowed to do for violation of a gag order. The bail can be, the conditions of bail can be tightened, but he cannot revoke bail based on the violation of a condition of release or violating the gag order without Mr. Trump being charged with a separate crime. Now, he could presumably be charged with contempt of court or maybe with witness intimidation or witness tampering, but that would require a separate trial. It's extremely unlikely that Alvin Bragg is going to charge Mr. Trump with a separate crime for it. And so at the end of the day, I think that's why the prosecutors have asked for a pretty weak slap on the wrist of $1,000 per violation of the gag order, because there's really not much this judge can do about it. I think people are outraged about this in the light of all of the threats of physical violence, correct, which are weighing on everyone's mind. But the Bail Reform Act really hamstrung what the judge can do in this situation.
Joyce, I want to go back. You referenced the social media posts coming up in the case of some of these jurors. How does all of that work, right? Is there a team, a subset of Trump's team that is culling these individual social media sites?
So it seems likely that Trump would be using a jury consultant. This is someone who specializes in jury selection in voir dire and would be giving them advice, looking at issues like jurors' body language, their background, their answers to questions. And obviously, in this day and age, their social media is a sort of a rich field to comb through for information. My understanding is that New York state law permits lawyers to do that so long as they don't do anything that would result in having contact with a potential juror. So it's fair game to look at someone's Facebook page. And we saw that happening today with the surfacing of material that Todd Blanche, Trump's lawyer, suggested to the judge, showed that those jurors should be struck for cause. And that's very important to Trump's team. They don't want to have to waste those precious peremptory strikes that they have. They want to see the judge remove jurors that they don't want serving on the jury for cause, that there's no limitation on the number of jurors who can be removed for that reason. That's why it's so important that the judge drew that line today, saying, I'm not going to let you go through social media endlessly. It's not possible that anything on social media that's tangential is grounds for a for-cause strike. It has to be actual bias against your client.
Well, and looking at the same time, you have social media stars on the right with their calls for people who support Donald Trump to actively get themselves on the jury. How much of a concern is that for the court?
It's a concern for this case. It's a concern for a lot of cases on both sides. I mean, this is a notion called jury nullification, where a jury might take into its own hands whether somebody should be convicted of a crime, not based on whether the crime was convicted, mm-hmm. but whether it should be illegal in the first place. And so there's been a lot of history throughout the last 100 years of juries that have nullified. But I think in this case, you're not going to run the real risk of it. I think the real risk is that Trump is going to wind up with a jury pool that he doesn't like, because he's really pulling from people that don't meet the demographic of what he's looking for. You're going to wind up with a lot of Democrats, well-educated people, and I think it's going to probably skew the other way. So while they're calling for it, I think it's unlikely.
So if you're his team, how are you trying to correct for that?
Well, I think you're using these peremptories in a very important way. You're using them strategically to try to bounce off the people you don't like. And I think there's really not much they can do about it. I don't think they're going to be able to call for it. We should all hope that there's a jury that actually judges this based on the facts and that's fair on both sides. But I don't think that there's much they can do to prevent it.
Joyce, you made the point that you were struck by the fact that Donald Trump is sitting there on his own, just as attorneys, not really a circle of support around him. Just how unusual is that?
Well, it is unusual. You will often see a family pull together or friends show up in court to support a defendant. That could still happen in this case. The courtroom is very crowded when a jury is being selected, so perhaps we'll see members of his family show up to support him as these proceedings get underway. But it's a very stark picture of a former president in a courtroom with none of his four grown children, without his wife, surrounded only by just a couple of aides and his Secret Service detail.
To say nothing of the nodding off, do you think he's going to testify?
I think that it's unlikely he's going to testify because it's unlikely that any defendant testifies. But I think what we need to really watch for is what people were calling those boring housekeeping things before the jury was selected. There are two hearings that need to happen. One's called Sandoval, one's called Molyneux. And that's whether the prosecution can cross-examine him on uncharged bad acts and other charged acts that he's been convicted of or that he's had adverse rulings on. And so that was delayed. The Judge Marchand delayed ruling on that. And I think we have to watch that closely, because his rulings there might really tip it one way or the other.
Joyce, you had Judge Marchand saying to expect opening statements Monday. What are you expecting to hear?
Well, what we'll hear is prosecutors will lay out their case for the jury. You don't get to argue your case. You can't argue the case in opening statement. You tell the jury what you expect the evidence will show, and you begin to explain the legal theory. This case is a little bit complicated because prosecutors will prove the misdemeanor crime of falsifying business records, and then they'll have to prove that that crime was committed to aid in the commission of or to conceal another crime. That's how this becomes a felony charge. They'll probably talk about campaign finance and tax charges. And as you can tell from my explanation, this gets a little bit complicated. So they'll have a task in front of them to explain how that will work to the jury. And then from the defense, obviously, we will see the primary theme that they will stick to throughout this jury. They will say the prosecution has failed to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And they will tell the jury, as you hear the evidence throughout this trial, always pay attention for that. They don't just have to give you evidence. They have to give you compelling evidence, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, or you cannot convict.
Joyce Vance, Duncan Levin, thank you both so much for getting us started tonight. Coming up, House Republicans today did their darndest to put on a united front, but do not be fooled. Evidence that the chaos caucus persists. That is later this hour. But first, reading the tea leaves in Supreme Court arguments today in a case that has the potential to upend the prosecution of January 6 rioters, Donald Trump himself. More on that right after this break. Today, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on a case that could determine the future of many January 6 defendants, and even Donald Trump himself. At issue is a law prohibiting the obstruction of an official proceeding, a statute that the Justice Department has used to prosecute a quarter of the January 6 rioters who've been charged for their role in trying to stop the counting of electoral votes. It is also one of the charges brought against Trump by Special Counsel Jack Smith in his federal elections case. Lawyers for one of the January 6 insurrectionists argued that the statute was not meant to apply to circumstances like the January 6 insurrection, while the government argued that the January 6 attack is precisely what obstruction of an official proceeding looks like. There was one exchange between conservative Justice Samuel Alito and the U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar.
So we've had a number of protests in the courtroom. Let's say that today, five people get up, one after the other, and they shout either keep the January 6th insurrectionists in jail or free the January 6th patriots. And as a result of this, our police officers have to remove them forcibly from the courtroom. Would that be a violation?
I think it's in a fundamentally different posture than if they had stormed into this courtroom, overrun the Supreme Court police, required the justices and other participants to flee for their safety, and done so with clear evidence
yes,
of intent
indeed.
To obstruct.
Absolutely. What happened on January 6th was very, very serious, and I'm not equating this with that.
Joining us now is Mary McCord, former acting assistant attorney general for national security at the U.S. Department of Justice and the co-host of the Prosecuting Donald Trump podcast. Mary, good to see you. Your sense of how the justices received these arguments today and if they gave any indication about which way they're leaning?
Well, we heard, I think, different concerns expressed by multiple different justices, and it's really kind of hard to count noses, I think, at this point. Mm-hmm. You just played an excerpt, of course, of Justice Alito trying to set forth, you know, a hypothetical to suggest that this application of the statute is too broad and could apply to something that I think Solicitor General Prelogar very, very well rebutted by saying that's not at all what happened here. That's not at all about the kind of violent attack on the Capitol with intent to disrupt the peaceful transition of power that happened here. But nevertheless, cases are decided based on how the law might apply in other situations. And I think the Solicitor General went on at various points to the argument to point out that de minimis types of things would not be covered because there is corrupt intent requirement, and there are other requirements that mean it has to have been a serious intent with that corrupt intent, knowing your conduct is wrongful, to actually disrupt, obstruct an official proceeding. But at the same time, we saw other justices, including Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, push pretty hard on the defendant's counsel, Mr. Fisher's counsel, suggesting that how could the clause that's being applied here, which says otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding, how can that mean anything other than otherwise doing it in any form? He had wanted to argue it has to be limited to altering records or destroying records. And those justices said that's not in the statute. Otherwise means otherwise. Then you had other justices, Amy Coney Barrett and even Ketanji Brown Jackson, suggesting, well, isn't there a middle road here maybe where even if the otherwise clause maybe doesn't apply in its natural form to a violent attack, couldn't it apply where there was an effort here to preclude documents, those being the electoral college votes, the certifications, to be transmitted to the vice president to open them for counting, for Congress to count them and tabulate the votes and certify the election? So even if you want to limit this to documents or records, is there a way to do it? So it's hard to read the tea leaves right now. There are clearly some disagreements, I'd say, between the Chief Justice and Justice Kagan, very clearly disagreements about how they think the statute should apply. But I do think it's important, and you're probably going to go there next, to say that whatever happens in this case does not necessarily dictate what will happen in the Jack Smith case brought against Donald Trump.
Mary, you can't be taking our producer's jobs. You already have like seven jobs. I have to admit that as a non-lawyer, the fact that the word otherwise was the word in the statute that took up so much airtime today was pretty surprising to me. Okay, so to your point about Donald Trump, the lawyer for the January 6th defendant argued that his client didn't obstruct an official proceeding because doing so requires manipulating evidence or a document in some way. So this is how he framed that argument to Justice Barrett. Take a listen.
This statute prohibits operation on specific evidence in some way, shape, or form. Attempting to stop a vote count or something like that is a very different act than actually changing a document or altering a document or creating a fake new
document.
Well,
he's obstructing evidence.
So to recap, he's saying there that creating a fake document would constitute obstruction of an official proceeding. If the justices agree with that interpretation, would that mean that Trump could still be charged over his role in getting fake electors to submit fake documents?
I think the answer is yes. Now, it all the devil's in details and what the Supreme Court would say. But again, one part of the multi-pronged scheme that underlies the two of the charges in the Jack Smith indictment, one, this same charge, obstructing an official proceeding, the other, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding. One of the major parts of that scheme is the fraudulent elector scheme. This is a scheme between Mr. Trump, as alleged, and others to urge, and in fact, this is what happened, that the electors in swing states who had intended, you know, to be Donald Trump electors went ahead, met on the date that the Electoral College meets to vote. They cast their ballots, even though he had not been certified the winner in the states, in those states, even though litigation there had failed and Joe Biden had been certified the winner. They then sent their Electoral College certificates, these signed certificates, up to the Capitol, to Vice President Pence and to others in the hopes that he would count those votes as opposed to the legitimate electoral ballots that had been set up by the Biden-Harris electors. So even here, if the government's able to prove this conspiracy they have charged, it would involve exactly what Mr. Green today admitted, the creation of fake documents. These were fake electoral college ballots. There are also, I would remind viewers, two other charges unrelated to this obstruction of official proceeding in the Jack Smith January 6th related indictment. And that is a conspiracy to defraud the United States and a conspiracy to deprive people of their civil rights. So even in the event that the Supreme Court would really go broad on a ruling that actually could call into question the obstruction of an official proceeding counts in the Jack Smith indictment, it would not touch those other counts. So people can feel safe in that.
You know, Mary, we always talk about how all of these cases are on a collision course, and today, no exception. Mary McCord, as always, thank you so much for your time. Still ahead for us tonight, Republicans in the House of Representatives are perhaps best known for their dysfunction. But if I told you that today they actually found something they agree on reliably enough to, you know, do something about it. Today, they united in order to deliver impeachment articles against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. That story is next.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons are commanded to keep silent on pain of imprisonment while the House of Representatives is exhibiting to the Senate of the United States articles of impeachment against Alejandro Nicolas Mayorkas, Secretary of Homeland Security.
The managers on the part of the House will proceed.
Today, House Republicans put on quite the show of unity. You'll remember that back in February, the House voted on party lines to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. And this afternoon, that process moved forward. Republican House impeachment managers, including Marjorie Taylor Greene and Andy Biggs, walked shoulder to shoulder through the halls of Congress to deliver the articles of impeachment to the U.S. Senate. The last time the House delivered articles of impeachment to oust a cabinet member was back in 1876. Then the Secretary of War was accused of trading military posts for profit. Now, in the year 2024, what has Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas done to merit impeachment? Republicans say he hasn't done enough to stop illegal border crossings. Now, mind you, that is not grounds for impeachment. In reality, Republicans are the one who sabotaged a border protection bill just a couple months ago, a fact that New York Representative Dan Goldman pointed out earlier today.
Unfortunately, the Republicans have put politics over our border security. They want chaos in order to win an election rather than to solve the problems. There was a policy bill. There was a policy change that would have significantly addressed the problems at the border. And instead, you all on the other side of the aisle sabotaged it, where you baselessly impeached the secretary who's trying to solve our problems at the southern border because you want to win it. You want to win in November.
The gentleman's time has expired.
You don't want to solve the problem.
So a politically motivated, baseless impeachment vote. Congrats to Republicans in Congress for accomplishing that. But don't be fooled by today's display of unity in the halls of Congress, because this is pretty much the only thing Republicans have managed to accomplish in this 118th Congress. Funding the government for a full year took half the fiscal year to do that. Bipartisan border deal shot down. Aid to Israel, Taiwan, and Ukraine stalled for months. In fact, fighting over the Ukraine aid bill has become so contentious among Republicans that Congresswoman Green has been threatening to oust Speaker Mike Johnson over it for weeks. And until today, Green stood alone in pushing for Johnson's ouster. Apparently, no other Republicans had the appetite to expel yet another speaker in less than 6 months. Until today, when Kentucky Congressman Tom Massey chose to join forces with Green. Today, he promised to co-sponsor her motion to vacate Speaker Johnson after Johnson announced a plan to advance those foreign aid bills this week. So, to recap, stalled legislation, infighting, quarrels over leadership, and the inability to fund our government or our allies, that certainly doesn't sound like unity to me. After the break, we're going to talk with Congressman Jamie Raskin about Republican dysfunction in Congress. That's next.
I am not resigning, and it is, in my view, an absurd notion that someone would bring a vacate motion when we are simply here trying to do our jobs.
Speaker Mike Johnson remained defiant today amid growing calls for his removal, led by Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. On Monday, Speaker Johnson unveiled his plan to bring three separate bills to the floor that would approve funding for Israel, Taiwan, and Ukraine. In response, Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massie decided Johnson should lose his speaker gavel. Massie announced today that he would join Congressman Green's motion to vacate. Massie said on social media that Johnson should do what former House Speaker John Boehner did and, quote, pre-announce his resignation. So far, Johnson has done the opposite. But the push to oust Mike Johnson is gaining momentum and adding to the dysfunction in the House. All while these Republicans band together to do the only thing they seem able to agree on, impeaching Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Joining me now is Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. He is the ranking member of the House Oversight Committee and the former lead impeachment manager of Trump's second impeachment trial. Congressman Raskin, it is so good to see you. You know, I was thinking about the fact that 2 weeks ago, you and I were talking about the fact that the impeachment seemed like it was reaching a dead end. And then I realized that you and I had been talking about the other politically motivated sham impeachment, the Biden impeachment. So the fact that we have to choose among them tells you something about Republicans' agenda here.
Well, the Mayorkas impeachment was the big consolation prize for the ultra-mega wing of the party, which did not get the Joe Biden impeachment they wanted. And that's why they did this instead. Of course, the Mayorkas impeachment is lacking the central thing that you need in an impeachment constitutionally, which is treason, bribery, or a high crime and another high crime and misdemeanor. And they don't have it. They have policy differences with Secretary Mayorkas, or at best, they have a claim of maladministration, which is precisely what the framers said you can't impeach someone over.
Look at them marching, though. They seem very committed. You got to give that to them. This morning, you had Secretary Mayorkas testifying before the House Appropriations Committee as they held their annual hearing on the DHS's budget request. Earlier this year, he worked on a bipartisan bill in the Senate. As you all know, House Republicans tanked that. Now you got him facing this impeachment. And Secretary Mayorkas, he appears pretty unfazed by this process. Earlier this month, he said, "When I say that I am not focused on the impeachment proceedings, I actually mean it. I will say this. That is my hope, that my time is not taken away from my work." Clearly a disconnect between the amount of things that is on Secretary Mayorkas's plate, right? The portfolio that he has, whether it is the U.S.-Mexico border, whether it is international threats, and what Republicans want him focused on.
Well, if you think about it, given that this is just a policy conflict, and at least a dozen Republican senators have acknowledged that over the last couple of days, the public is dramatically on the side of Mayorkas and the bipartisan Senate deal, which was blown up at the last minute by MAGA Republicans and Donald Trump, because Trump doesn't want a border solution. He wants a border crisis to run against. He's got nothing else in the tank. He's running on empty because he can't talk about abortion anymore, because the whole country has so decisively turned against him, whether we're talking about Kansas or Ohio or Pennsylvania or Florida. So they can't talk about that. So it's just immigration. He also has Vladimir Putin breathing down his neck, because Putin doesn't want $61 billion going to the people of Ukraine. So really what he's pursuing now is just an autocrat's agenda. And it's amazing to see the Republicans in the House just following him like lemmings.
Well, let me ask you about that. Today you had Republican Congressman Mike McCaul saying this before criticizing the Biden administration for, in his words, not projecting strength amid the ongoing conflicts in Ukraine and in Israel. Take a listen.
The world is on fire, and history will judge us by our actions. Were you Chamberlain or were you Churchill?
I mean, how seriously can you take them when that is their posturing, and yet their own caucus can't coalesce around a foreign aid bill?
Well, I think that was really directed at Mike Johnson. It wasn't directed at Joe Biden, who's been doing everything in his power to try to dislodge the foreign aid package he sent us several months ago now. But it's Mike Johnson who's fallen captive to the pro-Putin MAGA wing of the party, which might be dominant in the Republican caucus now. But he does seem to be trying to extricate himself from it with this succession of single issue bills so that we would get an up or down vote on Ukraine. And of course, the big majority in the House, pretty much every Democrat and maybe as much as 50% of the Republicans, but certainly 30 or 40% of the Republicans, but we would definitely have a big majority to do it. That's what Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and the extreme right of the party is so upset about. And for all we know, it is Donald Trump who's, calling the shots on that one.
Well, Congressman, let me ask you about that, because that was the other development today, the fact that you had Congressman Massey joining Marjorie Taylor Greene's efforts to remove Speaker Johnson. Do you think, are you hearing that more Republicans will join them?
Well, I've heard that there are a couple others in the wings that they've got ready to, you know, demonstrate their momentum. But of course, under the MAGA rules, which Speaker McCarthy had backed and pretty much the whole caucus was behind, any member of their caucus can file a motion to vacate the chair, meaning to topple the speaker. And so it does give the extremists elements in the party reporting directly to Donald Trump the power to dictate the course of events. It may be that Mike Johnson is just fed up with it. And he says, you know, look, if you want to vacate the chair, go ahead and do it. But I've got to move forward at this point. He has several committee chairs who seem to be determined to get us a vote on Ukraine. And they are starting to blow the whistle on how Putin's propaganda has begun to saturate the Republican caucus. And you have members like Marjorie Taylor Greene and like Matt Gaetz who basically parrot Putin's talking points. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene just a couple of days ago said that it was anti-Semitic to hold up aid to Israel in order to get aid to the Nazis in Ukraine or the Ukrainian Nazis, something like that. And this is just a classic Putin smear and disinformation tactic against the democratic nation of Ukraine, the only nation on earth that has a Jewish president other than Israel itself.
The fecklessness is a feature, not a bug. Congressman Jamie Raskin, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us tonight. And we have one more story this evening. New details on Israel's expected response to Iran's unprecedented retaliatory strike over the weekend. What it all means for Israel's ongoing military operation in Gaza. That is next. At this hour, we are awaiting Israel's response to the unprecedented Iranian attack that took place last weekend. For the first time in history, Iran launched a direct military attack against the state of Israel, though the impact was limited. No one was killed, according to the Israeli military. 99% of the attack was intercepted by Israel's aerial defense systems and its allies, namely the U.S., who shot down dozens of exploding drones and missiles. Iran issued these strikes in retaliation for a suspected Israeli airstrike that took place earlier this month, one that destroyed Iran's consulate in Syria and killed several Iranian military officers, including a high-ranking commander. Now the fear is that Israel's anticipated response could escalate tensions further, possibly sparking a wider regional war, something that allies of both Israel and Iran want to prevent. According to Axios, President Biden urged Prime Minister Netanyahu to exercise calm and take the win, warning that the U.S. will not support any Israeli counterattack against Iran. Today, four U.S. officials told NBC News Israel's response will be limited in scope and likely not on Iranian soil. And this is all happening as the devastating war in Gaza continues. CNN is reporting that the Israeli military was set to begin an invasion of Rafah this week, where over a million displaced civilians have taken refuge. Now, heightened tensions with Iran have reportedly put that offensive on hold. Joining me now, Bobby Ghosh, senior editor at Bloomberg Business, who has reported extensively in the Middle East. Bobby, thank you so much for being here and being with me. Your estimation of whether or not this expands?
Well, if Israel responds with a direct attack on Iranian soil, that is automatically an expansion. Mm-hmm. If Israel responds with a heavier than usual attack on Iranian proxies, whether that's in Lebanon or in Syria, that's an escalation. Mm-hmm. We've been seeing nothing but escalation in that region for a very, very long time. We were distracted for a time by what's going on in Gaza. Now we're being distracted by what's going on here. There are two different kinds of crises taking place simultaneously. One, a catastrophic humanitarian crisis. Another, a potential regional war that will have blowback for the whole of the world. So there's no corner of the Middle East in which you can peer and say, well, that looks hopeful.
I want to talk about the overlap between these two conflicts. But first, if in fact, Israel chooses to hit Iran proxies, how then do those proxies fire back?
Well, those proxies take their instruction largely from Iran itself. They do have a certain amount of autonomy. It varies. It depends on which proxy. Mm-hmm. So the Houthis in Yemen, for instance, seem to have a greater degree of autonomy than, say, the Hezbollah in Lebanon. So it sort of depends who you hit and how hard you hit them. If you take out a top commander of Hezbollah, then Hezbollah will feel obliged to respond. Hezbollah has stayed out of the fight with Israel to a substantial degree for a very long time. Remember, immediately after the terrorist attack on Israel on the 7th of October, the big concern was that when Israel inevitably responded to Hamas, that Hezbollah would enter the fight and that would be the trigger for a regional war. That didn't happen, thank goodness. The events of the last weekend with the Iranian attack, there have been concerns that that could be the trigger. Look, every time what you have is this what is called an escalation ladder, right? People from both sides are climbing up this ladder. You can't depend on both sides to remain rational the whole of the way. At some point, one side is going to get off the logical sequence of events and react, overreact, and trigger off the things. Just because they didn't go to war at the last provocation doesn't mean the next one will not be the one that triggers it all off. So that's the concern. That's why the Biden administration, as you said, is pushing so hard on Netanyahu, as Axios reported, to take the win. Netanyahu has an opportunity now to say, look, they attacked us. We proved that we can defend ourselves. They sent 300 missiles and drones our way, and our defense systems held up. They didn't land. They barely scratched us. That can be announced by a good politician. That can be announced as a victory. If he does that and walks away and focuses, yes, then that gives everybody a little breathing space, including the Biden administration. But he's facing pressure himself, Netanyahu. He may be a right-wing politician, but there are people to the right of him. Mm-hmm. And there's substantial support in the Israeli, among ordinary Israelis, for some sort of retaliation. If you're an ordinary Israeli citizen, even if you're not, let's say, politically active, a country that has been threatening your destruction for decades shoots 300 missiles and drones in your direction, mm-hmm. you expect your government to do something.
Migosh, as always, thank you so much for being with us. That is our show tonight. You can catch me back here on the weekend, 8 a.m. Eastern, Saturday and Sunday.